From WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North. It's an all-books show today. We'll start with British author of Life After Life, Kate Atkinson, who muses on the origin of characters.
It sounds like madness. All writers will say characters appear fully formed and they don't know how that happens. And I don't. They're suddenly there. I don't construct those characters. I don't sit down and put bits together like they're, you know, dolls I'm making. They just appear and that's them and their character is quite fixed.
Nigella Lawson stops by and talks about the joys of home-cooked Italian food. And after she ruined her one good tablecloth, Jen Lancaster learned the first Tao lesson of living like Martha Stewart.
Always have a contingency plan. Now, if I had three or four white tablecloths, I could have cleaned everything up and started over, and it would have been no problem. Instead, it was me swearing and sweating and having my husband run over the table with a hairdryer.
Lake Effect is next after the news. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North. Thanks so much for tuning in today. What if you had the chance to live your life again and again until you finally got it right? In British author Kate Atkinson's newest novel, Life After Life, Ursula Todd is born and dies. Ursula Todd is born and lives. And as the book progresses, the plot lines interweave and fold back on themselves as Ursula lives and dies in her many timelines. Some of those timelines are quite short, others quite lengthy and detailed. And through it all is the hulking shadow of World War II and the London Blitz. Life After Life finds Atkinson exploring chance and fate and how the smallest action or inaction by one person can profoundly affect the course of history, both personal and collective. Atkinson was in Milwaukee in April on a book tour, and she stopped in to talk with us then. Kate Atkinson, welcome to Lake Effect. Thanks so much for coming.
Thank you.
Beginning again and again and again, I think it's something that many of us would like to be able to do to correct something that we think, oh, if I'd only been able to do this or known something differently or chosen a different path. Ursula Todd gets to do this throughout the entire book, over and over.
But she's not aware she's doing it. And I think that's the difference. I've been thinking about this because if you get to choose, then you think, oh, I'll do this differently or I'll take a different path. But actually, all she knows is a kind of deja vu. She's not aware of those past lives. So she actually keeps making mistakes at the same time as she unconsciously corrects the others. So she doesn't have that much power. Someone else was saying that to me the other day. Oh, she gets to correct her mistakes. But actually, she's not even aware of it. So it's a different thing, isn't it? So she's not in the place where she can go and put, you know, £100 on the 310 at Cheltenham or the lottery or something. She's just kind of nosing her way through it in a way that I think is very uncomfortable for her. But she does rectify mistakes, but only out of kind of instinctive thing. Something sort of kicks in her brain and she says, oh, no, I won't step out onto that roof. You know.
Do you think that that's something that we all have, that sort of instinctive, if we listen to that still voice in ourselves?
I don't think many of us listen to that still voice.
No, I don't think we do, but I wonder if...
I think maybe we've grown up, you know, I mean, we're still Stone Age people. Our bodies are still Stone Age. Our brains probably still are. And I'm sure that if we lived a much more natural life closer to nature, we would actually live on our instincts a lot more. But we're so used to, as a civilized, and I use rabbit ears when I say civilized, society, that we've grown away from those things that we instinctively might think is, you know, it's not a good idea to go around there because there's the woolly mammoth that's about to pounce on me. Well, I don't know if woolly mammoths pounce, saber-toothed tigers maybe, but, you know, we've become so enmeshed in concrete and steel and a different kind of life that I don't think we do live by instincts.
One of the things I loved about reading this, the sense of her growing into herself.
Definitely. And I think those lives that she's living again and again, it's more like the way the image I would use is it's more like layers and layers and layers so that her character remains the same. She is the same person. She's certainly the same person almost from when we first meet her as a baby, I think. But those layers of experience somehow make her stronger. Even when she's still prone to making mistakes and saying hello to that wrong person, she's still growing in a a different way to the way that you and I would grow. You know, she's not on a journey. She's on some different kind of narrative.
The image that came to mind is like the fabric of her is getting more and more tightly woven each time I meet her in her next life.
Yes, that's a good image.
Life.
Yeah, and tougher. She gets tougher. All the time she gets tougher.
And funnier.
Yes, yes, she is. She becomes drier and more likable, I think. Well, she's not unlikable to begin with, but I think she becomes more and more a fully rounded person until, you know, when we leave her at the end, we have a very full picture of what she's like, I think.
The other very central part to this book is the Second World War and events leading up to it. The war itself, the Blitz in London, plays a huge part. And those particular timelines where she's in London were for me, I mean, just heartrending. Mm. And so I felt I was there. Mm. And what is it about the Second World War for you that made putting her in that particular time and place?
I would like it to have been me, I think. I would really like to have lived through the war. I know some people think that sounds sick, but actually I think it would have been an astonishing experience. And most people, you say that, you would go, oh my God, I wouldn't. The only other person who has instinctive, no, I know a couple of people who've said, oh God, yes, I would have lived through the war. And one of them is my cousin who's a soldier, and the other one is a woman who's written about the fiction about the Second World War. But I think to live your life at that heightened pitch must have been extraordinary. It is a unique event. Well, every event is unique. Every second is unique, I know. But that is something that will never occur again. We will never find ourselves under those conditions again. Even if we were to go to war and be bombarded, it certainly wouldn't be like that. And I think, you know, the Blitz lasted, oh, I don't know, 56, 57 days, 58 days, nonstop. It went on longer than that, but that was nonstop, nightly and sometimes daytime raids. And the effect that had on people, it made them, I think, more callous in many ways because they were seeing a lot of death, but it also made them more looser in all ways, you know, both morals and thinking and philosophy, because if you think that there's a chance that you might die tonight or tomorrow, then you do look at your life differently. So I think people probably viewed their own mortality in a very different way from the way that we do, because we live our lives as if we're going to live forever, whereas they were living their lives as if they might die tonight. And I think that's an interesting, fascinating thing. But also you do hear people say, particularly women, saying they had a good war and they enjoyed it, even though it's not the kind of thing that they should say. It's not very, you know, PC, but nonetheless, they enjoyed the freedom, I think.
For Ursula and for that time, you've said that this is sort of an exploration of what it meant to be British and what it meant to be English at that time. What do you think? What did you find out about being English at that time writing this book?
Oh, I don't know. You want to say it's about being English, but really maybe it's just about being in those circumstances. I think perhaps I stopped thinking of it being like that so much. But in a way, I mean, I wanted to recreate the Second World War for me, so that by fictionally recreating it, it's the only way I would get to live through that time, and in a much safer way, obviously. But I know it's difficult, because also then you start thinking, have I been infected by propaganda? But I think it showed up, you know, the stoicism of people, because when you read the actual, say, mass observation diaries, rather than looking towards propaganda, people are just getting on with things. They really are in a very rather downtrodden way. They're more interested in where they can get a torch battery from or a can of beans than they are really about their existence. But I don't know. I think there's a point in the book where Ursula says, you know, this is what I'm fighting for, and it is England. But what she's fighting for really is home and family. It's Fox Corner, where the family are. It's her brothers and sisters. It's what she's grown up with. That's England becomes a very small thing rather than this big patriotic, you know, we must fight.
And everyone's probably fighting
for their own little corner, yes.
Right.
Yes, I guess.
One of my favorite characters, Miss
yes.
Wolfe.
Yes.
And she talks about the importance of bearing witness. And I think that resonates throughout the entire book, because Ursula is almost bearing witness to her entire life over and over.
I was very pleased when I wrote that, because I realized that was a point I'd been working to without knowing what the sentence was that I was going to put there, because, you know, the Blitz is the heart of the book, and the book's always, for me, it was going to be about the Blitz. But I didn't know what it was I wanted to say until Miss Wolfe says it. And I think for me, in a way, I am bearing witness, because I now am bearing witness. As they said, in the future, people will bear witness to us. And I am that person. I mean, obviously, I'm not alone, but this is my way of bearing witness to them, I think. And so it goes on.
I was so viscerally in that place and that time. I could smell it. I didn't live through that. I'm not even English, you know. But there was something about the way Ursula lived through all of the various timelines, because she was in many different ones during the Blitz, that it just really struck. The other side of that, which I also found fascinating, is that you have her in timelines where she was not there at all and she was in Germany.
I can't really pinpoint the moment at which I thought she has to go to Germany as well. But I think because there is a her half-sibling who was adopted and is taken away, is brought up in Germany. In a way, it felt to me that there was a Todd, a member of the Todd family over there. And they do talk about him. And it's so funny to think that that baby is now the enemy. And there is an equality there. The Germans and the British, they're very alike. They're, you know, we're civilized. Well, again, I've got the rabbit ears here. But we're civilized European countries who have a long culture, with, you know, and at the beginning of the war, many English people were very upset that we were at war with Germany, because they had friends in Germany, they'd visited Germany, they'd holidayed in Germany. And so there's this sense that, you know, what is the difference given the right circumstances? I think, as Ursula says in the book, it could have been us, you know, and that's something that's never popular when I say it. But, you know, there is a parallel there. And of course, although we remember the Blitz, it's, you know, written into our history so very brightly, what we did to the Germans was infinitely worse. Germany was destroyed. There was fears that Germany would never, ever recover as a country, that it had gone because it was bombed so much. So it seemed only right, in a way, to go over to the other side and experience that for her.
Did you find, as you were working through these parallels and these, like, I'm trying to even find the right word. It's not repetition. It's the sort of the reversal and return and starting out again. Were there some stories that simply just didn't work, that you had to abort and say?
No. Somebody asked me this, I think, the other night. Did I get rid of a lot of things? Did I go back and, you know, things didn't work? And no, I just wrote it. It just was literally one sentence after the other. There was always just, it flowed as a book. It really did. I hardly rewrote it, to be honest.
I find that fascinating because it reads that way. It reads very seamless for something that isn't a linear narrative.
Yeah. No, there's a rhythm to it, though, because, and that rhythm is the base. She lives, she dies, she lives, she does. So that I think that life, those lives flowed in a way that the writing followed them. I think it was one of the easiest books I've ever written. And I think it was because also I was very emotionally engaged with it, so that, you know, some books you're more emotionally engaged with than others. One hopes one's always engaged with the book that you're writing. You just always like the book you're writing. But I think with this one, I really felt it on the pulses somehow.
How about the ending? Was it difficult to figure out where to stop?
No, I always knew where I was going to stop.
Really?
I generally know where I'm going to start, where I'm going to stop. It's just the middle bit that's difficult to fill in.
Those other 500 pages.
Yes, and that thought develops very strongly as you're writing. More and more you realize that this is the place that you're going to. And it's lovely to have a goal. I would hate to be writing in a completely open-ended, because I write in an open-ended way, but I do know the end. And so there's always somewhere to go. So that's kind of comforting when you're stuck in the middle of those 500 pages.
Do the goalposts ever shift, though? You have an idea, but does it ever tell you, you know, wait, no, we're really going to go over here?
Not really. Sometimes I had a, shall I do this or shall I do that moment? This character Tracy, shall I let her get away with it or shall I not? And for a long time I thought I wouldn't let her get away with it. And then I just thought, no, that's so cruel. Let her get away with it. So it was a kind of, that's a big shift by the sound of what I'm saying, but not really, because that was always the place I was going, was Tracy and whether she got away with it or not. So no, it's curious, because you would think that you're going to write all those 500 pages, you would change your mind about where it is you're going. But on the whole, I always end up there. Which is a miracle, honestly.
Well, I've heard other writers say that sometimes the characters dictate to them where, you know, it's like you said about Miss Wolfe, not knowing what you were thinking until she said it for you. And I was thinking, well, maybe sometimes Ursula or another character might say, you know, no, really, I want to go over here, you know, not there.
No, I think, you know, one does talk about characters as if they have lives of their own. But, you know, ultimately, I know that I'm in charge and that because it would be kind of madness if they were in charge. But it's the way you develop them, I suppose, that takes you. And the new characters suddenly spring. Because I love minor characters. So sometimes all those little minor characters that pop up, they're kind of, you know, they make you change slightly in direction. But on the whole, no, they don't. I don't know. I find character endlessly fascinating because, although, again, it sounds like madness, all writers will say characters appear fully formed and they don't know how that happens. And I don't. They're suddenly there. I don't construct those characters. I don't sit down and put bits together like they're, you know, dolls I'm making. They just appear and that's them. And their character is quite fixed, really, for the rest of the book. It's only their experiences that develop them, not anything in their real true nature. So, and I know that sounds slightly at odds with the idea that they're dictating, but I just don't understand character, and I would really like, I don't know, some kind of maybe a writing coach or a writing neurologist or somebody who could really explain the processes of what it is, what is happening when you're writing, because it's an odd thing, because a lot of it's unconscious, I think.
And there are some amazing small characters that may only be in one chapter or may have a through line also that parallels or that pops in different ways. Do you have particular favorites in this book? I have a couple that...
Well, I do particularly like Miss Wolf. I think Miss Wolf, in a way, is the moral center of the book. And I like all of the dogs. But Teddy, Ursula's baby brother, is always the real true heart of the book because I think it's for him that she, in a way, does everything, I think. And what happens to her, I think, is dictated by just that one love as well as the love of the whole world, I think. The two become meshed together, I think, for Ursula.
I also love her relationship with Pamela.
Pamela, yes.
I adore Pamela.
Yeah. She's very straightforward, jolly hockey sticks English girl.
And she says it so bluntly.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
But it's just... She's so refreshing,
and
I like her a great deal. And her insight and the foil that she provides for Ursula is just lovely in all of the different permutations that happen.
And they're always very close. They always, you know, they never fall out. They always love each other, which is nice. I have no siblings, so I have to invent all these siblings.
The siblings you wish you had.
Well, only the good ones, not Morris,
brother.
Someone said to me at an event in Canada, were you aware that you were making Hitler seem more attractive than Morris?
I hadn't put it that way, but you did, actually. I also like Hugh very much.
Oh, I love Hugh, yes.
Yeah,
that's
your dad.
He's a wonderful English gentleman. He's very sound, very, very sound. No, it's yes. Yes, I do like Hugh. It's funny that you talk about your characters as if they're somehow people.
Well, in a way they are, and
no,
for the readers,
no,
too.
They're not.
But they're not.
I know, they become like people. I know, I'm aware. Sometimes I do have to be careful because someone will tell me how much they love a character. I'm like, really?
Is there anyone in here that anyone has told you that? And you've thought, really, you like that person?
No, I can't remember. Somebody told me how much they disliked someone. And I was, no, someone told me, it was a Canadian journalist, I think, who told me how much they disliked Pamela. And I was like, why? And I thought, no, they must have completely misinterpreted her character because there's nothing unlikable about her, I don't think. But no, they totally dislike Pamela.
Interesting.
It's funny, isn't it?
It is.
Yeah.
It is how people react to that, as you say, as if they were actual people.
Yeah.
So now, what's next for you? Are you on another book?
Not really. I'm sort of thinking about another book. I've always planned to do a companion book to this, called A God in Ruins, which is a quotation from Emerson, Man is a God in Ruins, which I think is the most wonderful. I've really just been looking for a book to have that title, but it's Teddy's story, and more the grown-up Teddy, I think. So I haven't quite settled on how to make Teddy move from one book to the next, because he's always really, in a way, I know he grows up in life after life, but in a way he's always a little boy, so I have to find the grown-up Teddy's character.
And in a way he's almost a reflection.
He's a
of
cipher,
Ursula.
Yes, he is. So making Teddy come to life is a challenge, actually. That will be, in a way, a construction of character in some way. So it might not work, I don't know.
Well, we'll see.
We'll see.
We'll see. The book was one of those that I sat up until 1 a.m. to finish. Not because I was late. I actually finished it a week ago, but I couldn't put it down. And I as things started to get more and more wrapped up and I started to see where you were going, it's like, I want to know what happens to this person. So thank you so much for writing something that made me want to do that.
Oh, thank
and
you. That's very kind.
Such a pleasure to have you here, Kate Atkinson. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Kate Atkinson is the author of Life After Life. Atkinson is the prize-winning author of 6 novels, including Behind the Scenes at the Museum, which won the Whitbread Award for Book of the Year. She lives in Edinburgh when she's not on tour, and she was in Milwaukee in April and spoke with us then. We'll have another British author coming your way next. Celebrated cook and television personality Nigella Lawson. Her newest cookbook is Nigelissima, and it celebrates Italian home cooking. We'll be right back with that conversation when Lake Effect continues on an all-book show on WUWM. An All Books edition of Lake Effect continues now on WUWM. I'm Bonnie North. Nigella Lawson describes herself as a food enthusiast. She's a household name, a best-selling author, and the host of several successful television shows shown on the Food, E! And Style TV networks. What she is not, she will tell you quite emphatically, is a chef. She's a cook. And that word choice is crucial in describing Lawson's approach to food. Her newest cookbook, Nigelissima, Easy Italian-Inspired Recipes, is the latest in her efforts to convince home cooks that all they need to create delicious meals is a little knowledge and a love of cooking and eating. Nigelissima is, as the title says, inspired by traditional Italian recipes, but updated with Lawson's distinctive twists. Nigella Lawson was in Milwaukee in March as part of the book tour for Nigelissima, and she stopped by the studio then. Nigella, welcome back to Lake Effect.
It's always a pleasure to be here.
The new cookbook, I have to say, I've been drooling over it for the last few weeks, Nigelissima. What I find fascinating is that you wanted to be Italian from about a teenager, right?
Certainly I did.
And was it because of the food or because of something else?
No, it wasn't because of the food. The food came later and the food cemented this relationship. I must have seen an Italian film and thought that it looked so beautiful. And I suppose when you're not skinny and dark-haired, seeing a culture that celebrates that when it seems otherwise, especially sort of even in the old days, the sort of thin blonde image is forever being idealized, it gave me something to clutch onto. So I suspect there was an element of that. But really, there was another, perhaps more serious foundation, which is that I was a linguist at school and wanted to add Italian to my portfolio when I went to university. And so in order to be Italian, which I felt I had to be, and also in order to study Italian at university, I had to learn to speak Italian. It's not taught in schools. And so I went to work in Florence, to live and work in Florence. And there I really did fall in love with the food. And I fell in love with the food in perhaps the best way, which is I worked as a chambermaid, didn't earn much money, so had to shop and cook very carefully. And even if I went to restaurants, I had to order the cheapest things. So I learned about the value of simplicity and also about how to focus on what ingredients I could afford and make them taste good. I was also very lucky, even though it does sound like a cliche, but sometimes life is like that, which is the little hotel I worked in. I was befriended by the nonna, the granny of the establishment, because she got a bit lonely in the daytime. And although I, as staff, was not allowed in the kitchen, as soon as her son and daughter-in-law left, she would usher me in and I'd sit there and watch her cook and chat to her. So I learned how to speak Italian and how to cook Italian.
And I love the description that you had of it, is that you learned to speak like a greengrocer.
I'm afraid I did. I'm afraid I did because I, you know, I suppose if you're a chambermaid in Florence, you learn that sort of Florentine dialect. And it did amuse them at Oxford University enormously, when everyone else probably sounded extraordinarily patrician. Nowadays, I'm afraid I just sound like an English tourist. Even though I go back to Italy every year, you know, unless you're there all the time, you know, one gets rusty. The wonderful thing about Italians is that they are so accommodating and welcoming. It's not like the French, who like to point out your every grammatical error and, you know, personality flaw. The Italians are very warm and welcoming. And I found this to be the case not only in terms of language, but, you know, I had, for me, something very moving, which is that this book was translated into Italian and was published in Italy last fall. And I went there and I, you know, it's an impertinence, really, for me to have written this book. And they were so warm and welcoming about it. And that was very, very touching. And I feel, in a sense, and one should never seek validation because one is what one is, whether other people like it or not. But certainly it did make me feel accepted.
You were comparing the languages between France and Italy, the French and Italian. Do you find that the cooking represents, the way that they approach food is reflected in that ease that you talked about of the Italians? I mean, do they approach food in the same way? Do they approach cooking in the same way?
The French and the Italians?
Yeah.
Like, very differently, I think.
Yeah.
And actually in the same way that they approach language. So the French are very codified in their language, you know, and you're forbidden to use imported or loan words, whereas the Italians welcome them, and I rather like the way they just slip them in. You know, a bow window is a bovindo, spelled B-O-V-I-N-D-O. Why wouldn't it be? The French wouldn't allow that. And the Italians have that more relaxed attitude towards cooking. But it isn't just, but they are relaxed, but they are also incredibly formal in the sense that their traditions are their traditions, and they're very fiercely regional. And this is where writing about Italian food from the point of view as a foreigner actually works, because someone from Tuscany will have perhaps scant regard for the cooking of Lazio, you know, around Rome, or certainly won't cook in that way. But if you're so far removed because you come from another country, then they're more likely to be interested, because it doesn't feel like an erosion of their own traditions. But for me, why Italian cooking and food is, I suppose, such a match with my own particular feelings about the kitchen, is that France finds its highest expression in the great chefs and the great restaurants, whereas Italian cooking, its heart, its soul, everything resides in the home kitchen and the home cook. And I'm not a chef, so for me, Italian food is very much my kind of food. And I think that's why Italian food is so popular throughout the world.
In the United States, certainly in the last, you know, 20 years or so, we've moved away from the idea that everything Italian has a red sauce. You know,
yes.
We've gotten to know that there are so many of these regional traditions that you talk about. Are the Italians moving those traditions forward, or are they clinging very hard to what they once did?
Before I answer that, I want to defend Italian-American cooking, because it has an authenticity of its own, because it belongs to a historical moment and it is how it evolved, like language. Now, the Italians seem to me to be very wedded to their own traditions, and they will not veer from them when they're cooking those traditional recipes. However, they are extraordinarily open to other cuisines now, in a way they weren't before. But that's also because they didn't have access to the ingredients and they didn't actually have access to the recipes. But now, because of the internet and cable TV, I have to say Italians have got a passion for the Anglo-American baking tradition. So if you're in Italy now, they will talk very excitedly and proudly about I muffin, and they do make crumble, which they often call spricciolata, but they do also call it crumble. They're very interested in adding to their tradition. They don't really have an enormously strong baking tradition because of their very late industrialization and because of the immense poverty in Italy. Homes did not have ovens until relatively recently. And when I say relatively recently, I mean historically. So that is new. And I find that Italians seem to have a very lively interest in other cuisines, because actually up till now they have been perhaps more hermetically sealed.
Do you think that immigration has something to do with that, that the more porous boundaries of the EU have helped with that, bringing in other kinds of culinary traditions?
I'm not sure that has made a huge difference, because actually, unlike a lot of the other European countries, they don't seem to have the same, you know, for example, Germany has got a lot of Turkish and Greek food. France has got, for obvious reasons, Algerian and Vietnamese cooking. But what I think has made a big difference is that because so many Italians left Italy and went to Argentina, America, Australia, England, that they in turn return to the old country to see those members of their family who still live there, or else just as a sort of nostalgic sort of route following enterprise. And because of that, they bring back the food that they've adopted in their native countries. I think they're listening to people of Italian descent telling them, oh, and this is how we cook it in Australia, or this is how we cook it in America. When I was in Venice last time, for the first time ever, and I've been to Venice nearly every year now for 30 years, I saw avocados being sold. And now, that's very strange, because normally they do not import other people's fruit and veg. And you could argue it's not a good thing, and many people would. Nevertheless, I think we all are very grateful. Well, I speak as someone who comes from an island that if we didn't import food, we'd be living on cabbages and parsnips for most of the year. So I think that we sentimentally think that Italians are not allowed to do anything except for, you know, be nonna in the kitchen cooking what they've always cooked. But actually, we all are interested in the cuisines of other people and, you know, ingredients that maybe we haven't encountered before. Why shouldn't Italians do likewise?
And incorporate things into their traditions. Exactly. It's like, oh, there's a new spice, or here's a new herb that I haven't.
Yes, yeah. They are slightly wary of that. I mean, they do not like it. For example, if you were to make spaghetti carbonara and suddenly decide you want to put, as you often see in non-Italian recipes, suddenly someone puts a mushroom in or an onion in and they think, what is going on here? You can't do that. However, if you want to make a pasta sauce with different ingredients and don't call it by an Italian name, that's fine. I was worried when I went to Italy that they would all, you know, beat me about the head with their skillets for writing recipes that were not authentically Italian. But they said to me, no, actually, it's difficult because we're very, very bound by tradition. And that wonderful though that is, that can be very constraining. You, however, being non-Italian, can take liberties and you can play. And that playfulness then can rub off on us. And somehow that gives us permission. So I thought, when I was at school, I was always told I was a bad influence. So I'm quite happy now I'm grown up to be told I'm a bad influence, as long as it's received warmly.
And it's in the service of wonderful food, which
yes.
This is. How did you pick the recipes for this book? Which you had to not obviously choose everything that you might have liked to include.
Two things made it easier. One, I had an absolute rule that I wasn't going to repeat any recipes I'd written before. You know, I've written so many Italian recipes that actually that ruled out an awful lot, and it ruled out most traditional recipes. I also find that I put in those recipes which I found I repeated most often in my own kitchen at home, which is the only place I cook, so that if I found a recipe, however much I liked it the first time, if I found I didn't cook it again, whether it's because I forgot about it or because it required too much effort, then I didn't put it in the book. You know, I have a kind of choose it or lose it approach. I chose recipes that I felt evangelical about, that I knew that almost that I wanted to push onto other people. I've always had what I call the school gates test, that when I write a book, because I always have to whittle things down because it starts off and really it could have been three times this length, that I imagine a fellow mother is at the school gates and is saying, oh, hi, I'm going to cook your ... tonight. If I feel anything other than excitement and joy, that's it, the recipe gets scrapped. It's not enough for me that a recipe works. I have to want to cook it about three times, and I have to be tremendously excited and positive about the idea of anyone else cooking it.
that's a wonderful way to weed them out.
It is. And actually, you know, sometimes a recipe just hasn't found its time. So sometimes I find that recipes that don't get put in a book do not die. You know, I have a life outside the printed covers. Plus, I hope I'll write other books. So maybe it's just that it isn't right yet now, or just simply that I've gone over too many pages.
Are there recipes in here that might surprise home cooks for maybe the combination of flavors or something different and unusual that they might not be expecting?
Oh, it's very hard for me to know exactly. I mean, I try to think very much of the flavors of Italy, which often creating recipes that aren't exactly Italian. So, for example, I think of Italy as a nation of licorice lovers. And I made really a bit like the sort of chocolate pudding you would get here, but instead of using chocolate, I melted some licorice sort of lozenges in hot water. That's quite an odd thing to do. And then, you know, it's the normal thing, bit of milk, bit of cream, some cornstarch. And that's quite an odd combination, but it really works if you're a licorice lover. And otherwise, I'm trying to think, yes, I suppose so. I mean, because generally speaking, the sort of pesto that everyone knows and loves is from Genoa and has, you know, basil and pine nuts. And I did a version which is from Sicily, which has almonds, tomatoes, capers, anchovies and raisins or currants, because, of course, Sicily has that Moorish influence, so you will get that incredibly easy, no-cook sauce, just put it all in a processor and blitz it. So I suppose you have to be convinced first, well, why am I putting raisins in my spaghetti sauce? But actually, it works, because everything is about balance. So if you have the saltiness of some anchovies and also the slight sharpness of some capers, it automatically makes sense that a couple of raisins are going to balance everything out.
That sounds delicious. It sounds
very easy.
Yeah. And that was one of the other things that I know you tried to do in this, is to keep things relatively simple for the home cook.
You're being very kind to me when you say that I tried to do that, but I don't have the expertise to make complicated recipes, and I am a home cook, and also I cook in the same context my readers cook, which is after a busy day and when I need to get supper on the table quickly and feed, you know, quite a few people and also try and organize homework, so that my recipes suit my life, so therefore I think they suit other people's. It's not a marketing strategy, and it's not because I'm trying to be kind. I know my limitations.
Nigella, it has been such a pleasure to see you again. Thank you so much for stopping by.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
Nigella Lawson is the author of 8 internationally best-selling cookbooks, including her latest, Nigelissima, Easy Italian-Inspired Recipes. Lawson was in Milwaukee in the spring for a book signing event, and she spoke with us then. We will take one last break on this all-book show, and then writer Jen Lancaster gets in touch with her inner Martha Stewart. Stay tuned for that. You're listening to Lake Effect on Milwaukee Public Radio.
Chestnuts roasting on an open fire, Jack Frost nipping at your nose.
It's an all-books edition of Lake Effect on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North, and it's great to have you with us. There are few people who don't have strong opinions about Martha Stewart. Some see her as the purveyor of unnecessarily glittered pine cones and homemade soaps. Others devoutly follow her teachings, from the wisdom of an alphabetized spice rack to how to make the perfect roast duck with caramelized parsnips. And then there are those who can't forget her time behind bars for charges related to insider trading. Writer Jen Lancaster holds all these opinions of Ms. Stewart and loves her all the more for it. Moved by Martha's organization, creativity, and spunk, Lancaster decided to emulate the homemaking maven. She documents the effort in her book, The Tao of Martha, My Year of Living, or Why I'm Never Getting All of That Glitter Off the Dog. She stopped by the studio in July and told Lake Effect Stephanie Lecce why she decided to channel her inner Martha.
What inspired me was having a really
terrible 2011. Not for any big reason, just a lot of first world stupid problems. So because I had a bad 2011, by the time the end of the year rolled around, I didn't even want to acknowledge Christmas. That just seemed like one more thing that I had to do. So I told my husband, we're going to skip Christmas this year. We're just going to go right into 2012, and that's all there is to it. He thought about it, and he agreed. Then he thought about it and decided, no, that's not what we're going to do. We're going to flip 2011, the biggest burden in the entire world, and we're going to have a huge celebration. So we got guys to put lights in the front of the house, and we had this big holiday party. I was responsible for doing all of the food prep for the holiday party, and I thought, we'll have a big Italian buffet. I'll make my special bolognese sauce recipe. So where all of this is going is it took me 3.5 hours tearing my house apart to find this stupid recipe because 6 months earlier, I had my school's alumni magazine came up to interview me, and I wanted them to think that I kept a neat house, so I shoved all the crap from my counters into cabinets. And it turns out that my bolognese sauce recipe was in our kitchen gun cabinet. We didn't install it. We just happened to have a kitchen gun cabinet. And the thing that started this entire book was when my husband made the comment, I wonder if Martha Stewart stashes her crap in her kitchen gun cabinet.
Now, first, I want to have you tell us about your relationship with Martha Stewart.
My relationship with Martha Stewart now is very good. In the past, before she went to prison, I didn't like her. I didn't care for her. I thought she was smug. What made me turn around to Team Martha is how she behaved in and after prison. She went there. She made friends. She made microwave dinners. She made ponchos. She really rose to the occasion because she could have gone in and then just gone anonymous after that. But she came back and reclaimed the name Martha Stewart and proceeded as though nothing ever happened. I began to respect that. And I think I was also, when she got out of prison, at the point in my life where making a nice home became important and learning to cook became important. So what she did began to coincide with what I wanted to accomplish.
What reaction to this idea for this project of living a year in the style of Martha Stewart, what reaction did you get from other people, most especially your husband, Fletch?
Well, my husband thought this was the greatest possible thing to ever happen in our entire lives. Like a few years ago, I decided to take on this year-long weight loss project. So for a year, all I did was stomp around the house swearing and angry every time I saw him eating a piece of pie. So that was not one of his more favorite book projects. But for this one, the house was spotless. Things became organized. I cooked all the time. I decorated. We had parties. He thought this was phenomenal. He said that this book is 18 years of everything he's been trying to get me to be. So he was thrilled. My friends were a little bit more dubious because a lot of these guys I knew in college, and they remember me, hemming my kitchen curtains with a steak knife. So they did not think that I would be able to attain Martha Stewart's lifestyle.
Well, what were the lifestyle aspects you were trying to emulate and bring into yours?
I wanted to concentrate on the areas that were really relevant to my life. I wasn't looking at this as a stunt project. I honestly was looking at this as a happiness project. I had this beautiful pit bull named Maisie, and 3.5, 4 years ago, she was diagnosed with mast cell tumors. Her vet said she had 6 months. She lasted another 3.5 years. And I knew that we were going to lose her last year. So what I wanted to do was find a way to stockpile some happiness because I knew that at some point last year, I would have a really rough go of it. So that's the reason behind this book. So I decided to concentrate on things that were meaningful to me, like Martha can tell you how to build your own chicken coop. That's not something I'm going to do. That's not something that's going to enhance my quality of life. But figuring out how to throw a party where I actually got to spend time with my guests and enjoy them and not think the entire time they're there, get out. All I'm going to do is wash your dishes. I mean, that was important to me. It was important to me to be able to make dinners on the fly. It was important for me to keep things organized. So those are the areas in which I concentrated.
What were some of the tasks that you took on, the Martha-inspired projects, that came more easily versus some that you maybe struggled with a little bit?
The first task that I took on that came easily was planning an Easter. And I thought it was going to go very, very well. But to begin, see, it went horribly wrong and horribly right. To begin, we were going, my husband and I were going to hollow out Easter eggs and then dip them, and then we would have painted Easter eggs. And that's something that I haven't done in, oh, at least 30 years. So normally we are food snobs, and we normally buy the free-range, organic, non-bee-cut eggs that are $6 a carton, and they make fried eggs very precious. But for this one, I went with the dollar eggs, and I'm sorry that these chickens weren't hugged and coddled. I'm sorry. I feel bad. So we started to hollow them out. Every time we tried to drill a hole in it, they would explode in such a spectacular fashion. There were just sunbursts of yolks on my ceiling. And then, see, again, I thought I had it together because I had a plan. So when I went to put the tablecloth on the table, it turns out the only one we had that fit was still covered in bolognese sauce stains. So I had to use a shorter tablecloth and a longer tablecloth, and it turned into like this tablecloth mullet. But it was okay, and I put these big vases of apple blossoms out, and it looked so beautiful, and I had it all staged, ready to get up the next morning and just cook the food for the brunch. And in the night, my cats knocked over all of the apple blossoms. So my one remaining tablecloth was just saturated. I had Post-it notes on everything, so those bled into the tablecloth. And this is what taught me that Martha Stewart was more than just the sum of her parts. There was an actual Tao of her way of doing things. And the first Tao lesson I learned from this is to always have a contingency plan. Now, if I had 3 or 4 white tablecloths, I could have cleaned everything up and started over, and it would have been no problem. Instead, it was me swearing and sweating and having my husband run over the table with the hairdryer.
You said before that you embarked upon this as a kind of happiness project. Where did the happiness come in? Because it sounds like there was a lot of frustration as well.
The happiness came in from learning to do things. For example, one of the things that I took on was knitting. I knew that I had to do a crafting component for this book somehow, and there's a lot of crafts out there that I have no desire to do. Apparently sewing, not my thing. I'm always afraid that I'm going to run over my fingers when I press the little gas pedal thing. But what did work for me was knitting. So I thought, oh, this will be really hilarious if I knit everybody in my life a scarf for Christmas. They don't have to be good. I just have to do it and say that I did it. What I didn't realize is how much I would love knitting. And the thing is, when you make a handmade gift for someone, my failing was in thinking that handmade gifts are equal to cheap. Each of the scarves I made took anywhere from $60 to $100 worth of yarn, number one, coupled with my time. So these things are worth about $8,000 each. I mean, you could get a used Honda for one of my scarves. What was unexpected and just so delightful was the amount of time I thought about each person for whom I was making the gifts. One of my friends has really blue eyes, so I was making the scarf thinking, this will pull out the blue in her eyes, and this will be gorgeous. And everybody loved these things, and I did not expect the praise that I got from doing this project. That was awesome.
Did you find your relationships were affected as you were going through this project?
This process has made me a more thoughtful person, and that's probably about the best thing that's come of it. For example, I was getting ready to leave for book tour about a month ago, and one of my friends had major, major surgery, and I knew I wasn't going to be here. She's single, so she doesn't have anyone who lives with her to help her, and I knew I wanted to do something to make things easier for her. So because of Martha, I learned how to budget my time. So even though I was getting ready for book tour, I was able to take a couple of weekends and make 10 different pre-made things for her. So when she was in her house, she could have chicken soup, she could have chicken enchiladas, she could have meatballs. So I had all of these meals pre-made for her. And I think before I had done this project, I wouldn't have known the time management skills to do this. I wouldn't have been thoughtful like this, and I wouldn't have had the skill. And because of this book, I was able to do something really nice for someone who is important to me.
Where were the points of departure between what you were doing, really doing in life, and what Martha says to do.
Well, one of the major points of departure was our 4th of July party. And I talked about my dog, and it, right before the 4th of July party, she took a terrible turn, and we really thought that we were going to lose her. So we proceeded with the party because I needed something to focus on. And somehow in my anxiety and in my grief, the classy 4th of July party where everyone would wear their Madras shorts and eat lobster with drawn butter turned into this redneck hee-haw hoedown. And I think that happened the minute that I bought the Founding Father rubber duckies on Amazon. And the other thing about that is, like, the month of July, I wanted to follow Martha's planning calendar. In her magazines, she has this calendar. On this day, you deadhead the roses. On this day, you do this. So I started to follow her calendar. And on July 3rd, the only thing on her calendar was to take a swim and to go antiquing. On nowhere did it said, call the emergency vet 400 times to find out about your dog. It didn't say, make 9,000 runs to Costco and 16 runs to the grocery store because it's 100 degrees out and all the ice in the cooler is melting the second you open it. So I got mad at Martha and I started to call her smug. She and I, in my head, are cool now. But I was not a fan of hers in July.
So it seems to me that part of the philosophy, the Tao of Martha, is recognizing where your limitations are, where your time is best spent, and what you want to do that will make you happy versus what maybe other people expect of you.
Exactly. That is the perfect description. What I found out more than anything was that I have to try. There were so many things in my life that I'd never done because it seemed hard, so I never tried, like making cheesecake. Cheesecake seemed like the hardest thing in the entire world because it requires a special pan and a water bath, and it seemed so daunting. But once I did it, I realized how easy it was. So now I'm never going to be a sucker paying $25 for a pre-made cheesecake when I can do it at home for $4 and have it be delicious with no artificial preservatives. So it's one of those things that I can do to make my friends happy, my family happy, to save money, which really hits a number of my parameters that I was hoping for in this book.
Do you think your readers would be surprised that this philosophy is about more than glittering pine cones? That maybe Martha Stewart has more to her than the kind of maybe superficial aspects of decorating and finding the perfect window treatment?
I think that this is really inspiring my readers to take a look at their lives and figure out what's not working and improve on it.
Jen Lancaster, thank you so much for coming in and sharing what you learned from Martha Stewart with us.
Thank you so much.
Jen Lancaster's latest book is The Tao of Martha, My Year of Living, or Why I'm Never Getting All of That Glitter Off of the Dog. She spoke with Stephanie Lecce before a reading at the Barnes & Noble in Wauwatosa in July. There is a link to her website called Jensylvania from WUWM.com/lakeeffect. And that closes the book on this edition of the show. We'll have our traditional all-music Christmas Day show tomorrow, so I hope you'll join us then. I'm Bonnie North. Thanks so much for tuning in today. You're listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee. Stay tuned. Fresh air comes your way next.
It's that time.